Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of 91.7 KALW, Loco Innovative Public Radio for San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus.
And from that lovely oasis of thought, we migrate to this lovely oasis of the air, and from the air to the internet via our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org. And you can also download our podcast soon, the whole archive, very soon, folks, of Philosophy Talk via our webpage as well.
Ken, today's topic is dreaming, and I must admit I dreamt last night about finally getting a blog up, but then I slept a little late this morning and I didn't do it.
So you're getting close.
I'm getting close. Now, you know, dreaming, every philosopher teaches Descartes in their intro course, even if they're not a historian, and we always have to talk about, or we get to talk, we have the opportunity, the privilege to talk about Descartes' question, whether we know the difference between dreaming and reality. How do we know we're not dreaming? Is that what today's program is about?
No, but let me ask you a question about that. How do we know we're not dreaming? I know I'm not dreaming. I'm awake in the studio with you. Why would Descartes be so bothered about that question? He really was bothered about it. Why would anybody be so bothered about that question?
Well, you know, you can answer that question on two levels. Within the Meditations, which is where he worries about it, he's got this skeptical project. How do I know anything? Well, the first thing I know is that I exist and have experiences. Then how do I know the experiences really give me the truth about anything, given that I believe that some of my experiences, namely my dreams, don't? So it's part of the problem of his project in that book.
Right. He's trying to show that he's not trapped in his own mind. It's not just him and his ideas, as in dreaming. Reality's waking experience is different from that. Okay, that's a philosophical concern, and it's a rich and engaging one. But there's also scientific concerns with dreaming and psychological concern with dreaming. Freud got this whole business really off the ground by writing The Interpretation of Dreams way back in 1899, and said dreams have this deep psychological and even biological function, right? In our dreams, we get to satisfy all these wishes that we can't satisfy in our waking life, and lots of people believe that for a very long time.
Well, you know, I read The Interpretation of Dreams in college, and I found it quite convincing, and my own dreams seem to be telling me something. I don't always find something that they seem to be telling me that's fairly deep about myself. But I gather that Freud's ideas, starting with kind of the empirical research into the brain and stuff in the 70s, have not held up too well.
No, I don't think, right. I think they've made maybe a little bit of a comeback. But starting in the 70s, neuroscientists studying dreams began to believe, you know, dreaming is just a random flux of the sleeping brain, and they don't really have any meaning, and they don't really have any deep function. So too bad for Freud. But, you know, I find that hard to believe, because if you ask people about their dreams, you know, they seem really meaningful. They seem that they have a lot of content.
Well, you know, my problem is I have a lot of recurring dreams. I don't want to get into the details on the public radio, but why would you have the same dream over and over again if it's just a random process? But, you know, maybe we should have a little more to talk about than just our own dreams. Maybe we should know something about some other dreams.
And our roving philosophical reporter, Stephanie Lowe, went out and asked lots of people about their dreams. She files this report.
So tell me about one of the strangest dreams you've ever had.
I guess one of the strangest reoccurring dreams when I was a child was the falling, and then waking up and you're in your bed. And in some ways, I kind of liked it. It was more like a rush that you get at an amusement park or a roller coaster.
The strangest dream I ever had was that I was on a bicycle riding through Paris with my daughter on my shoulders. And, well, it was funny because a week later I was riding my bicycle through Paris with my daughter on my shoulders.
Well, there's been loads of strange dreams. One of them, I was crushing babies into drawers and things like that. That was quite disturbing.
One of the strangest dreams I've ever had was this dream where I woke up in the morning and all of a sudden I heard this choir of sound, and it scared me completely, and I was overwhelmed by the hauntingness of this sound of choir, but it sounded like death. And so every time I hear sound in my dreams rather than visuals, like strong sounds, they usually startle me and I wake up.
Well, I suppose the most favorite dreams were the kind that were a continuation, where you might wake up and go back to sleep and find you're in the second part or the third part or the fourth part of a dream, which didn't always happen.
Oh, fly. I used to have the dreams of flying, you know. I could push my arms up and down like a bird, and I would concentrate on it. Somehow I could go up and fly in the air, you know, and fly over all my, the people on the playground and that sort of thing. And that's a lovely dream, you know.
Always trying to just fly. It's because you always wake up exhausted. Probably I'm trying to get away from work or life at that point.
I think the only ones I really, really enjoy are the flying dreams. And when I'm flying, I always feel as if, oh, I can fly again, and I've remembered how to do it.
I dreamt that I was walking down the beach with a girl, and up ahead of me, I saw a humongous shrimp. And there was like a, you know, soda, like the rings from the six-pack wrapped around his beak. And so I took it off, and he let me ride him around town. So I became the sheriff of, like, the town that I was in. And I would ride this around this humongous shrimp and, like, deal law, you know.
What do you think that dream meant to you?
I think it shows that, you know, there are more important things out there than getting the girl in the end. I don't know, you know, like riding a humongous shrimp.
I think it's just the way your mind programs things out. It's a necessary part of being alive is dreaming.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Stephanie Lowe.
Thanks, Stephanie, and thanks to all your dreamers. And you know, Ken, it's the most amazing thing. A large part of my life has suddenly fallen into place because I have a recurring dream of living in a town where there's a sheriff that rides around on a big shrimp. Isn't that amazing? I'm John Perry, and with me is Ken Taylor.
And normally, folks, we'd be joined. Our guest today is Owen Flanagan. Normally, he'd join us right about now, but this is the wonder of live radio. You know, it has this immediacy, and when things go wrong, you're stuck. And through technical difficulties, right now it's you, me, and John. And
okay.
So this will give you folks a chance to weigh in earlier than ordinarily.
Right.
So, John, let me ask you, what's a dream?
What is a dream? Well, that's a good question. And I would give the classic answer, the one that Descartes seemed to believe, the one that most people believe. Dreams are experiences you have while you're asleep. And unlike the experiences you have when you're awake, they do not occur as a result of sensory input, or at least not in the normal way, and they do not carry information about the world around you. So dreams are experiences, fictional experiences that we have when we're asleep. Now, my old teacher Norman Malcolm thought that couldn't be right. He thought it was contradictory to have experiences while you're asleep. He thought dreams were just stories you told you to wake up. But I've never been convinced of that. So that's what I think dreams are.
Well, that's what you think. You know, we'd like to find out what our listeners think, too. Like I said, our guest can't be with us through the technical difficulty. If you want to weigh in, give us a call. Join the conversation early. 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or you can also call us toll-free if you have the misfortune of being outside the Bay Area, 1-800-525-9917. And finally, we're monitoring our emails, comments at philosophytalk.org. Come, give us a call, send in an email.
Okay, Ken, so now you tell me, given that dreams are experiences we have when we're asleep, and they don't tell us about the external world, and ordinary experiences do tell us about the external world, how do you answer Descartes' question?
Wait a minute.
Why do you think you know you're awake?
I think you're being too quick. I'm not sure. Why do you say dreams are an experience that we have when we're asleep? Because experience, what's an imagination? When I imagine something, what am I doing? Is that an experience? When I imagine myself, the king of the world, as I seldom do, mm-hmm. Am I having an experience? Seems
well,
not.
Well, maybe in some sense of experience you're not, but in my sense of experience
okay.
You are. I use experience as the most general term for
okay.
What's going on in the mind. So something's going on in your mind. It's as if something were happening to you, right? You're falling through space. You're making love to a beautiful woman. You're giving a lecture that everybody's spellbound, but you're in your underwear. I don't know what your dreams are like, but that's what my dreams are like.
Okay, so you're wondering, given if we say dreams are mentation that you have while you're asleep.
Yes, that's much better word,
yeah.
Mentation. Thank you.
Well,
you've given me a $6 word that I can use instead of experience, and I thank you very much.
And it's all just in our heads. Right? And when we're awake, all we're really doing is having experiences and thoughts. how could we ever distinguish dreaming from being awake? And if we can't distinguish dreaming from being awake, then aren't we kind of stuck when we're awake? Maybe there isn't a world out there. Well, even here's a problem, though. Even if I could experience dreaming from being awake, wouldn't I still be stuck with this problem? Because suppose I say, well, being awake is the more coherent, connected stream of this stuff. And sleeping, the stuff you have in your dream, is kind of these incoherent interrupts, right, mm-hmm. that come from time to time and can't be put together in a continuing narrative. The waking stuff can be put together in a continuing narrative, and that's the difference. Would that solve Descartes' problem of, you know, why my experience connects up to reality?
Given a few little premises in between, that's what the solution Descartes comes up with. He thinks that to make that a good solution, you first have to prove the existence of God, the reliability of things you can't doubt, and a few things like that. But the problem comes up with Russell a couple hundred years later. Russell says, what if you had a continuing dream that picked up every night
right. Where
it left off in the morning? Could you tell the difference? Of course, maybe the fact that you couldn't tell the difference isn't a philosophical problem. It just would be a certain kind of insanity.
You know, we don't have our guests with us, but we do have our callers with us, and Dan in San Francisco is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Dan.
Hi, thank you very much. You know, dreams I don't think are that hard to explain based on some of the science that's known. They happen during the period of rapid eye movement when the motor functions of the body are shut off, or the voluntary motor functions. So the brain can then do anything it wants, and it can even kind of component itself out. It's like if you took the carburetor out of a car and played with it a little bit. Well, the brain is doing the same thing during dreaming.
But let me ask you a question, Dan. That sounds very good, and I know that's what science tells us. But when you say the brain can do what it wants, what determines what the brain wants to do? Is the brain different from me? Is it what I want to do? But I'm asleep.
Oh, I see your point. So it's sort of like the homunculus thing.
Who's this brain deciding what I'm going to dream about?
But I think that's easy to answer naturalistically. It's whatever happens. So, and if the question is, well, how does that happen? I mean, we could let's maybe save that for the next step. But what happens is, the portion of your brain that has to do with lectures and having no clothes takes precedence. And you know why? So why is that? Well, maybe it's, as some people think, it's to prepare you so that you're really sure that you never do go to your lecture with no clothes on.
Right, there you go. There you go.
Right now you've kind of given us two answers. We've got this part of the brain that's just kind of doing random stuff, and we've got this other part of the brain that's worried about whether I'm going to show up at my lecture with no clothes on. So it sounds like there's a kind of purposeless aspect of dreaming, but then there's sort of a purposeful aspect of dreaming.
Just like one bit of scientific data here. Although 85% of dreaming takes place in REM sleep, there's also, they've recently discovered, non-REM sleep dreaming, and they have different characters. The REM sleep dreaming is much more emotionally toned and lively, and the non-REM sleep dream is kind of flaccid and not emotionally toned. But I'll remind you, you're listening to Philosophy Talk. Our subject today is dreaming. Our guest, through the technical difficulties, is not with us, but you're with us.
So thanks, Dan, for that interesting comment. We get a little science into things, never hurts.
We've been talking about the nature of dreams, how dream states are different from wakeful states, the difference between dreaming and imagining or hallucinating. In our next segment, we'll ask whether dreams have meaning and whether they speak for hidden parts of the self. Join us by calling 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Outside the Bay Area, 1-800-525-9917. What dreams mean or don't mean, plus your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
Gary Wright and Dreamweaver. This is Philosophy Talk, and I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Our topic today, dreaming. What do you think? Do our dreams have meanings? Do they speak for hidden parts of the self? Do they reveal to us our secret desires and fears, or are they just the random, meaningless flux of the sleeping brain?
Tell us your thoughts. Tell us your dreams. The number is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Outside the Bay Area, call toll-free at 1-800-525-9917. You can also email us at comments@philosophytalk.org.
Penny in Albany's on the line. Penny, what do you want to add to this conversation.
Hi, good morning. Well, as an Indigenous person, I would like to add that for me personally, I've identified three levels of dreaming. And the first level of dreaming is kind of when the mind or the brain or some part of ourselves is dumping needless information. And those might be nonsensical dreams or just dreams about life that don't have any profoundness to them. And the second level of dreaming is when I'm processing life in a deeper way, and there might be something that my unconscious is attempting to tell my sleeping mind. And the third level of dreaming is much more extra normal, and in that level of dreaming, I might have meetings with people that I don't know about until I talk to them 3 or 4 weeks later or a couple of years later. Or I might be learning something in the dream that then I need to know in my daily life that I haven't learned in the waking life.
Well, Penny, what do you account for this third level? Is this supernatural? Is it some deep biological knowledge that has never come to conscious? What's going on there?
Well, I don't know what it is, but I think it has to do with how we're all connected, all humanity and all of life is connected in some way that science hasn't yet developed the means to detect. And Indigenous people have always known this. And, you know, all humans are actually Indigenous people, but somehow some groups of humans strayed away from that Indigenous knowledge.
Now, in terms of your own background, do you have some lore about dreams that comes to you through your, I take it a part of some Native American tribe here. Do you have some lore that comes to you through your mother and father back about that?
I wouldn't call it lore because that is lessening what I'm talking about. I would call it when I was growing up. Every morning we sat around the breakfast table and talked about our dreams.
Oh, that's cool.
And so I grew up with that kind of tradition of talking about our dreams. And I think that made me be open to noticing dreaming at different levels.
So when you wake up in the morning, you talk about your dreams. Is everything go, no matter how embarrassing the dream was? You sit around the breakfast table and talk about it?
Well, yeah, with my family. How can you be embarrassed with your family?
Oh, well, I mean, I don't know about your family, but I could be. But thanks, Penny, for the call. I mean, there's lots of stuff there. I want to say that lots of traditions have lots of views about what dreams are like. The ancient Greeks thought that dreams were the voice of the gods, at least some of them, lots of them were, and they had these complicated dream books and these experts who could interpret your dreams. But, you know, I'm not sure that all this is borne out by the results of modern science and modern psychology. I mean, the dominant view in modern kind of neuroscience seems to be that dreams don't have any meaning, that they're a product of our trying to interpret the random flux of the brain and all this Freudian stuff and all this stuff about the connection. There's no scientific basis for it, but I think people find that hard to accept.
Well, you know, Ken, live radio isn't a scientific lab. It's a lab of human experience.
Well, that's
certainly true. Call in. Tell us your dreams. Have you ever had a dream that, like Penny says, accurately predicted events, something that would be very hard to explain scientifically? This is your chance, folks. Give us a call. Ken's going to give you the numbers.
415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134 or 1-800-525-9917. And Shelley in Oakland's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Shelley.
Hi. I'm really enjoying your show, and I'm the perfect person to call in because I'm a dreamer. I dream a lot.
And you think your dreams have meaning and significance?
Actually, no. I think I don't believe in those dream books. I believe they have meaning. They come from your subconscious. They're like reaching in to that part of you maybe an artist would go into to get ideas and thoughts. But I think it's the feelings you feel about the dream when you wake up that have the meaning. You can't look in a book and really interpret your dream, although there's kind of archetypal images.
Right.
You really have to look inside yourself, and it's the feeling that gives you the meaning.
So you think the meaning of dreams is more like something we put on them, let's see if I'm putting words in your mouth or not. And what we put on them kind of reveals something about us, our projects, our plans, our hopes, our fears. Is that a fair paraphrase of what you, of your thoughts or not?
Something like that. I think they're coming from us in our own imagery and our own feelings. And
So Shelley, do you have recurring dreams?
You're
a big dreamer. Do you have recurring dreams?
Yes, I do have recurring dreams.
So how does that fit in with the way you look at dreams?
It's just how I feel. Like I have recurring dreams, and they have themes. It could be fear, could be love, loss. But
So the picture I'm getting is that maybe our brain is just disposing of, you know, today's unused materials, but then another part of ourself looks through those materials and picks up themes that matter to it. And these, of course, might be recurring. They might come over and over. Is that the right picture for you?
I think that's true. I think, you know, depending on where we are in our lives and what we're going through, we dream different things, you know, at different times. And as a child, you might dream you're being chased, and then it might not go away as an adult, but you might dream about other things, losing love when you're old. You know, it just depends on your life.
Well, I have a recurring dream, and in this dream, I have to quit being a professor of philosophy at Stanford because I have to go back and finish the requirements for my BA at the little college I went to. And the requirements that I have to finish are always taking a math class. And then I find I can't get the math class, and I can't get my BA, and I'm really stuck without a job. Now, that comes up again and again. It seems a superficial analysis might be say I'm a little worried about my math skills.
Well, but that's true. But Shelley, thanks for the call. You raised some interesting points. Millie and Berkeley's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Millie. Hello.
Thank you. I wanted to witness to dreams as wishes, and my particular experience, which I wrote to Oliver Sacks about, but he wasn't at the moment up on visual problems. My experience was that I was totally blind for a year and then got some sight back. And in the period when I was totally blind and subsequently, I have had dreams where I see very, very powerful images, very often related to sorting things out, you know, a whole lot of different moldings in a fancy house or kinds of clothing or pebbles on a beach, things that require visual acuity. I've had dreams where then when I wake up, I feel that the picture is still in front of my eyes. And when I was totally blind, it was just the picture of whatever I was dreaming that would then fade away rather like a TV screen to a little dot of light. Subsequently, when I could see better, I would have these images superimposed on my pretty paltry vision, and I'd have trouble getting rid of the images. And what it has made me realize is, at least from my unscientific pursuit of the matter, that people have visions and that they're really in their heads, you know?
Right, but they have visions and they're really, let's say this, they have things that they interpret as visions and they're really in their heads. But I'm not sure, do you think that these visions give us some deep connection to reality that we don't get some other way? So that the dream is a way of seeing that? I mean, I'm not quite sure what you're saying.
Well, I guess I don't really want to try to pursue the vision thing, but I believe that people who think they see the Virgin walking with a little child on a hillside see it. That is, it's in their eye.
Yeah.
There, in their eye.
So you're...
Which is different from saying it's on the hillside.
So your experience kind of taught you that the kind of the subjective contribution even to ordinary vision is much greater than you might have thought before
exactly.
You had this period of blindness.
Wow. Exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
Thanks so much for the call, Millie. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about dreams, and we'd like to know what you think about dreams, whether you've had any startling dreams, whether you think dreams are speaking for some hidden part of yourself, whether you think, like many neuroscientists think, dreams are just the random flux of the sleeping brain. Join us, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Outside the Bay Area, 1-800-525-9917. And we've got Tony on the line, I think. Is that right? Tony, are you there?
Hi, yeah, I'm here.
What's your comment or question?
Well, I mean, for me, my dreams certainly are my imagination, you know, run wild without any checks or balances against it. But what I was commenting on is how often the biology of the day interacts with it. I know if I'm extremely tired, for example, I have one sort of dream. I had an example last night of what the artist Winsor McCay used to had a whole series of stories called Dreams of the Rarebit Fiend, where the people would have nightmares from eating cheese. And I'll say after having cheesecake before going to bed last night, it was a very unpleasant set of nightmares. And I'm sure it had more to do with the biology of the situation than, you know, my imagination wanting to do horrible things and witnessing horrible stuff.
Right, right. Tony, that, you know, that, I think thanks for this insightful call and lots of interesting things there. And I think it kind of goes well with something. Look, lots of neuroscience, again, says that when we're asleep, the lower stems, lower parts of the brain generate all this activity. All this neural activity is happening there. And the higher parts of the brain, the frontal cortex, has to make sense of all this neural activity, because that's what the frontal cortex does. It makes sense of things, and it just goes to work making sense. But right, so it's not as though the dream is kind of the combination of the random neural fluctuation and our attempts to make sense. And you could say that's where the meaning comes from in a dream, because we're trying to make sense given the ways we have of making sense of anything. Right?
But is that so far from what Freud had in mind? I mean, why is the frontal part of our brain making the sense it does of our dreams? Why does it make the same sense of what must be different static random activity night after night, week after week, year after year?
Well, because it's not the dynamic of wish fulfillment. It's not the unconscious. It's not the discharge of unconscious urges and stuff. It's not that can't get into the realm of consciousness when waking. That was Freud's view. Mm-hmm. Right? There's this drama that's driven by the unconscious, and all these wishes that can't be satisfied because the superego won't let them be satisfied. But in sleep, they get turned into something that can be satisfied, and then they're done away with. It's not anything like that. It's just, here we are trying to make sense of the world, and all this random stuff pops up. There's no kind of internal dynamic within the unconscious that explains this. That's the difference.
Well, I'm skeptical. Let's wait and see if Freud doesn't make a comeback.
Yeah. Gwen in San Francisco is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Gwen.
Hi, thank you. I'm really enjoying your show. It's a lot of fun. I wanted to agree with Penny with the three levels of dreaming that she described as in a way, like coherently, like the random sort of physical discharging of the daily thoughts that you're just sort of, you know, purging in a way. And then maybe the second level, which is more of a kind of a universal connectedness that you might have with somebody, or just like meaningful dreams to you, where you're working out ideas, you're working out emotions that actually do affect your life in the sense that it's an experience that you have that does in fact like move you through whatever you're living at the moment. And then I do, you know, I kind of have a feeling that the psychic realm, which you know, typically we think of as like supernatural, but I tend to think that given quantum physics and all the things that we can't possibly understand about dark matter, et cetera, and so on, and the non-existence of time, you know, that maybe that has eventual, you know, scientific meaning. But I wanted to just mention when I first got on the line that in the second level, that Jung talked about alchemy, and he looked to alchemy, which was the science in the Middle Ages of transforming base metals into gold.
Right.
So you're going beyond Freud to Jung now.
Yeah.
I'm finding deeper meanings in dreams.
I prefer Jung.
Okay.
Okay.
And I thought, I've been comparing dreams with some friends, and since I sort of became aware of the alchemical dreams, I'm not sure if I mean, I'm sure this is like another hour-long show, but and I won't go there. But I do find that there are certain types of dreams that you have where you wake up and you feel like you really were moved, and you were really somewhere, and it was really profound, and that you learned a lot. And I think those dreams can be categorized but through the visual, you know, the catalog of visual emblems in that dream as being one of three types of alchemical dreams.
So you think that you have all the respect in the world for science and all that, but you still think Freud and especially Jung have something to tell us about dreams?
I think that that human beings study dreams and are aware of dreams, and that there is a way of looking at all the pieces that are out there and bringing them together into one coherent philosophy.
Well, thanks, Gwen, for those insights.
Okay.
Gwen, thanks a lot. I still think, I don't want to be the skeptic here, but I still think, you know, dreams are meaningful because when we're awake, we find meaning in them. I don't think they're revealing to us hidden meanings. I think we're interpreting creatures. We're meaning-mongering creatures. And so I want to defend that in our next segment a little bit.
Yeah, we'll have to come back to that when we're awake.
Yeah. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing dreams with you, our listeners.
We've been talking a lot about the meaning or lack thereof in our dreams. Maybe next segment we'll ask whether there's any real deep evolutionary function that they perform.
Yeah, that's one question we'll ask, and whatever questions are on your mind. The stuff that dreams are made of, plus your calls and emails, when Philosophy Talk continues.
The Eurythmics and Sweet Dreams Are Made of This. Annie Lennox, lead singer. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. So why do we dream at all? Does the ability to dream play some deep role in our lives? Is there some biological purpose that dreams serve? Would anything be missing if we didn't dream? Tell us what you think.
Yeah, tell us what you think. Join us by calling 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Outside the barrier, call toll-free 1-800-525-9917. Do you ever remember a time when you couldn't distinguish between a dream and reality? Do you agree with a lot of our callers that dreams, in spite of modern science, are very meaningful? Let us know.
So, John, you disagree with me. I think dreams don't have any real intrinsic meaning. They're not any intrinsic hidden messages from secret selves. But we do find meaning in them because we find meaning everywhere. We find, you know, human beings are great at finding meaning. So, but you think I'm wrong about that?
Well, let's kind of back up a minute. What do we mean by the dream? A lot of modern science tells us dreams are meaningless, and they're saying that it seems to me what they're saying is that what provokes the dream is meaningless. It's just the unloading of the trash barrel from the day's computational activity or just stuff coming in because you ate too much. That seems perfectly plausible to me. I don't think dreams are any great Freudian plot played on our mind by our submind. But then we actually do experience things that we can put words to. We say, I was flying, I was delivering a lecture, and sometimes very complicated things. I was dreaming that I was dreaming. Now, I think those thoughts, those contents occur when we're asleep. I mean, I don't know how to prove that, and I don't think it would be up to me to prove it, but maybe some experiments could shed a lot of light on it. But I think those are things that are simultaneous with the dream, not just stories we tell when we wake up.
Well, I kind of agree with that, but it's a complicated issue. Drew in San Francisco is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Drew.
Well, hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to make an observation about when dreams are even remembered, at least for me. When I'm going to be stressed and living in the city, I usually can't even remember my dreams. But when we go up to my boyfriend's country place, which I've been doing for decades with him, and I'm less stressed, I don't think it's the locale, I not only sleep better, but I have dreams that I remember. But I don't think I'm sleeping better because I have the dreams. I think almost the dreams are just a function of perhaps maybe being more relaxed or being less stressed or having more mental freedom. So what does that say about the content of a dream as meaning anything if it's just a function of how, I mean, in the city I often don't sleep well at all. I mean, I'm self-employed and there's just way too much going on. I love waking up and having that sense of, oh, the dream. But then it fades usually before I could even hope to analyze it.
Drew, you're raising an important point. I don't know if you realize. Crick of DNA of Watson and Crick fame and his collaborators have been working on dreams in the last years. And Crick thinks that we dream to forget, that it's part of the sort of biological function of dream. It's kind of, they're kind of a trash collector right?
We have all this
neural trash, and the dream kind of organizes it, and we sort through it, and most of it we discard, and some of it maybe we keep. But he argues that if we didn't dream, we couldn't learn new things because the mind would quickly be filled up with useless neural interconnections.
Like our computer screen, you just dump it in your trash.
Right, exactly.
And that is, I think, a sense that I have when I'm up there and I have this, and I wake up and I think, oh, I had this wonderful dream, or wasn't that vivid, and it fades very quickly. I don't regret that it fades. It's more like a release. It's like, ah, yeah. Good.
Right. So yeah. you should look at some of Crick's work, because that's neuroscience, and it's just along the lines you're talking about.
That's Crick and Watson that did the DNA.
Yeah, well, Watson hasn't done the dream work, but yeah, it's the Crick of Crick and Watson.
It says Crick and Mitchison.
Yeah.
Proposes.
So it was Crick's later work.
Yeah. They call it the reverse learning theory.
Yeah. So thanks a lot for the call, John in Oakland's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, John.
Hi. I was calling. I just wanted to relate. A predictive dream experience that I had that really...
John, there's some strange scratching sound. Is that coming from your phone?
Maybe it is. Let me try something.
I'm having a very hard time hearing you.
Is that better?
No, but keep going.
My frontal cortex is busy interpreting that. Yeah.
Keep going.
That's kind.
How about that?
Yeah,
that's better.
Okay. Sorry about that. And first of all, I guess I want to say that I... almost never remember my dreams. It's as if I don't have dreams. But one morning I woke up, and the first thing I noticed was that I did remember my dream, and that was unusual. And the next thing I noticed was that I dreamed about a friend of mine in college who had been a friend in my freshman year, and this is about 12 years after I graduated from college, and I hadn't even thought about this guy in all that time, and so that was just really seemed strange that I don't know why I thought of this guy. His name is Colin, and so I didn't really think too much more about it until I went to work, and that way I was just sitting in my office, and the phone rang, and it was Colin, and he had seen my name in a book somewhere and just decided to look me up, and it seemed very striking to me that for some reason the thoughts of this guy came into my mind just before he called me, when he's really somebody I had completely forgotten about.
So what are you making of this, John? I'm not quite sure what you want to make of this.
Yeah, so I don't know. I mean, it brought up all these thoughts of, you know, paranormal stories or sort of a universal unconsciousness or something. It just really made me question whether,
yeah,
you know, there's something in dreams that somehow taps into something beyond.
I'm sorry, I have to be the skeptic again. I know that's my role in this particular episode, but see, look, I do think, I go back to the lower parts of the brain generate all this neural activity, and the higher parts of the brain are trying to make sense of it,
right,
trying the best it can to make coherent sense of it. And since it's all random flux and jetsam, it's hard for it to make sense of it. So it comes up with all these interpretations that are really weird. Now, in our waking lives, when we remember these things, they seem to us like an oracular voice from some strange place. So it would be, I think it's kind of perfectly understandable that we interpret our dreams as the voice of the hidden self, or the voice of God, or the voice of nature. I mean, it's kind of understandable because we can't really make sense otherwise in our conscious waking life of where they're coming from.
Now, Ken, let me
see. But I don't think we should be taken too in by that.
Well, let me see if I really get this radical view of yours correct.
Okay.
Right. Now, the natural interpretation of this sort of thing, like John has and I have, is that there's some slight rip in the seam of reality, and information is leaking back from the future into the present.
Yeah, right.
Now, you're rejecting that common sense view.
Yeah, I'm rejecting that common sense view. But I'm explaining why somebody like John could feel as though that's the right explanation, because this random flux from our lower brain, we can't make much sense of it, so we put elaborate interpretations on it, because we're sense-mongering creatures. Right. What do you think of that, John? What do you think, John, on the radio, on the television? What do you think of that?
Yeah, you're a sense mongering creature, right?
What do you think, John?
I don't know. I guess it really did seem like the information from the dream came before the experience in reality, and so that's what I mean. And I didn't guess that it would be an actual something taking information from the future, but in the same way that, for example, you know, if you have two twins who are separated and one of them suddenly dies a violent death and the other one has this experience of it right in that moment,
yeah.
that there may be some kind of some underlying connection that we don't understand that may have a totally scientific basis.
Okay, so look, I haven't talked you out of this, but thanks for the call.
Look at it this way, Ken. If string theory is right, then there's like 8 or 12 dimensions of reality we're not even aware of. Could be all kinds of information seeping back along those dimensions.
We got time for one last caller. Mark in San Bruto's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Mark.
Yeah, thank you. Definitely enjoying the subject in your show, and my... My comment is that when I was very young, maybe 5, 6, 7, I had a reoccurring dream that came around for 2 or 3 years. And I'd be in my bedroom. It'd be in the evening when my parents would go to bed. And I'd get this strange feeling that would come over me. And it was a little bit frightening. And I would watch these elephants, sort of ornately costumed, sort of dancing around my room, and then I was accompanied by some very odd music that I wasn't really familiar with. Anyway, like I said, this reoccurred at a certain time of the year, it seemed like to me, for 2 or 3 years, and it was much, much later. They stopped eventually, and then much, much later, when I was in my my teens, 16 or 17, I discovered East Indian raga music. And the music made a lot of sense to me, and it recalled me back to that music I had heard that it once sort of frightened me, all the dissonances and so forth.
So what are you trying to tell us, Mark? What are you trying to tell us?
I guess I'm trying to tell you that I felt it was almost like a reincarnation kind of experience that I didn't understand when I was younger, and then later on I sort of rediscovered what that was.
Okay.
So you discovered the meaning of your young dreams much later in life.
Yes.
Yeah.
But suppose you much later in life, you'd be instead of getting into that kind of music, you'd become a Republican. You could have still gone back and interpreted your dreams.
Well, right. Yeah, Mark.
Thanks
a lot, Mark. You know, the interpretive faculty of the human being can do lots of saving, can make sense of lots of stuff, even if it has to be extravagant. You know, there's one thing that we didn't mention. We didn't really talk about the function of dreams, and that's the last point we can make here, is that, you know what, almost all mammals, did you know this, dream, or at least they have REM sleep, it's an ancient thing.
If you look at your dog, if I look at my dog, he often seems to be dreaming just in terms of the way he's sleeping restlessly. And sometimes you see the paws move or something, you think, he's chasing a rabbit
or a
squirrel.
John, what did we learn today? I mean, briefly, what do you think? Where's your head?
Oh, I think my head is that in the rich fabric of human experience, dreams play an important role, and it's very hard to believe they don't mean something. Freud was right about that. He went on and on about that. And yet science tells us and common sense tells us how much can they mean? It's a dilemma that continues.
You know what I learned? Even when the technical difficulties interfere, you and I can rise to the occasion, and so can our guests. Anyway, folks, this conversation continues on our blog, blog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is cogito ergo blogo, I think, therefore I blog.
And you can download podcasts of our program from our website as well. Now, since dreaming has been a recurring theme in films, from The Wizard of Oz to more recent one, let's take Philosophy Talk to the movies. Hey, Ken, let's talk about a movie that everyone can go see right now.
I bet you I know what movie you have in mind, The Science of Sleep, because it's on the topic we've been talking about the whole show.
Yeah, and it's at all the obscure movie theaters all over the Bay Area.
This movie is made by a very philosophical director. We already did one of his movies, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. The director is Michel Gondry.
Yeah, Michel Gondry, and The Eternal Sunshine was a bit more of a normal Hollywood-type film with a beginning and a middle and an end, even though the characters were having their memories played with. Here, not only the characters, but the viewers are really having their minds played with.
It's a love story, The Science of Sleep, basically. So Stefan is the male character, the male protagonist, and Stephanie is the girl next door that he loves, except she doesn't know that he lives next door for a while. And... Well, the complicated thing about it is that the narrative of the movie is told
as far as one can tell, partly through his waking hours, and then also partly through his dreaming hours.
Mm-hmm.
And at first, there's kind of a clear separation. Well, a kind of a clear separation between the waking hours and the dreaming hours. And then the waking and the dreaming get so intertwined. I mean, yeah. The narrative in the waking and the narrative in the dreaming get so intertwined. At some point, you really don't know. Is he dreaming this? Is this really happening? I mean, you just don't know.
And at some points, he doesn't know either. One nice thing about the portrayal of dreams is it has this kind of split consciousness that we often have in dreams, where we are one of the characters in the dream, but we're also an observer. And they handle that by having him have his own sort of like, America's funniest videos. I guess this would be France's weirdest videos.
Right.
He's kind of the MC of this show, but then he's in the show too. And then he sometimes looks into the video monitor where his dream is occurring, and sometimes he goes and looks through an open door and I don't know what's going on in the open door.
Sometimes the dreams are represented in cartoonish kind of ways. There's a scene in which he's pouring water on something, on a plant or something. I can't remember what he was pouring water on. And suddenly the water turns into cartoon water. It's like wrapping paper or something, and it's sparkly, and it pours out, and then they pour it down on the street, and it makes this man wet, and suddenly it's real water. I mean, was he dreaming part of that or not? Or just are reality and dreams really, contra Descartes and Berkeley, really indistinguishable?
Now, Bertrand Russell posed a problem, a kind of a mega Descartes problem, which is if your dream took up every night where it left off the morning before, pretty soon you wouldn't know when you were dreaming and when you weren't. Now, what he didn't say is if your life was as incoherent as most dreams are, and the two kind of met so that neither was more coherent than the other, then you might have trouble telling when one left off and the other began. And you could say that about his life. His life was rather bizarre. He had a bizarre job with bizarre people, and his dreams were fairly coherent. I mean,
fairly.
For dreams, they were coherent.
I also think that the science of sleep is about insanity versus sanity and appearance versus reality, because this Stefan has had this disorder that he can't tell the difference between dreaming and being awake, and that's represented as some kind of malady of his mind, and it all just merges in his mind sometimes. He doesn't know, right? But it represents this inability to determine whether you're dreaming or awake. You know, fortunately, this movie, though powerful and evocative, wasn't as coherent as normal waking life. So I don't think I was dreaming while I was watching it.
No, I was perfectly aware of when I left the movie theater.
Yeah.
The dreaming is a fairly common conceit in films. We have the Wizard of Oz. Is that all a dream, or is that historically what happened to Dorothy? It's kind of discouraging. It's all a Technicolor part is a dream.
Yeah.
But I guess it's kind of represented that way.
You know what? I think what the movie leaves us, the message the movie leaves us with? Question mark.
Question mark. Just like in philosophy talk.
Oh, Annie M., it's you.
There, lie quiet now. You just had a bad dream.
Sure.
But it wasn't a dream. This was a real, truly live place.
If you've got some ideas of movies that have a philosophical angle that we should look at, old movies, new movies, small movies that many people haven't seen, send us an email and let us know. We'll take a look at it.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2006.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
Special thanks to Devin Strolovich, Neil Van Leeuwen, Ben Temption, and Mark Stone. Our senior consulting producer is Gordon Earle.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University.
Also from the Friends of Philosophy Talk and the members of KALW Local Public Radio, San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed in this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
The conversation continues on our website, www.philosophytalk.org. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.